This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Very good afternoon. So good to have you along today. A little later this hour, you will join the Vigas family celebrating its centenary of farming in the far south of Western Australia. And also being a Monday, Terry Birkin is going to be along this hour to go through the yarding and the prices at today's cattle sale at Mushay. Just before we get to that full report, just before the news at 1 o'clock today, here's just a little preview for you.
Morning, Belinda. Today we had 409 live weight, no calves, but one donkey.
One donkey. I wonder how much it's sold for. Send through your guess for me and see if you are right on the money. 0448 922 604. You can text through with your guess of what that donkey went for at the Mushay Cattle Market today. All will be revealed a little later on today, 12:06 here on the Country Hour. Well, Sheep Producers Australia says a survey of almost 650 WA farmers reveals the current seasonal and market conditions are some of the toughest on record, with some considering getting out of sheep altogether. Bonnie Skinner is the CEO of Sheep Producers Australia and presented the findings of the recent survey to the Dry Season Task Force on Friday. Bonnie, what was your message to the task force?
I think what was really, you know, there were some key themes that came out of the presentation, and I think that really the point has to be made around this survey. I know people question the usefulness of these sorts of things, but when there is a lot of anecdotal information coming up from the ground, it really helps groups like the task force, like the minister's office, to really be able to understand the data behind this so that timely decisions can be made, particularly around support packages and what the size of those packages need to be, where help needs to be deployed. So, throughout the survey, we obviously had asked for people to give their location information if they felt comfortable. That was an optional input field in the questionnaire, but a lot of people did put that information in. And what we were able to do was look at where the greatest areas of need were across the southwest and the south coast there, so that we know where to deploy resources and help on the ground. So that was a really strong lot of information that came through the task force. I think overwhelmingly as well, you know, people who are answering the survey are saying that this is a hard situation, and harder than what they've been through before. And that there certainly is a mix of people that really do need help with accessing feed, and very much so, we know roughage is a really key demand amongst people. There are also people who at the moment have the ability to feed through this situation, but given that we've got a late break still for most people who are affected, getting access to that feed and that roughage is really critical. So they were some of the key things that came across. I think also in terms of the types of support that people were asking for, you know, certainly six major themes that we kind of looked at, you know, in terms of the feedback that were provided around feed, financial support and subsidies, freight, live export was a big one that came through, and markets and market access. So, you know, that also helps inform where we need to deploy those resources. And I think, you know, again, the financial support that people are looking for is around feed and water and freight. So that was a point of discussion at the meeting on Friday, as well as, you know, just having the ability to sell their sheep into markets. And I guess an unwillingness for people to want to be able to take government handouts in a situation like this.
And were they also letting you know about their plans for the flock going forward at this point, and the implications there for the size of the flock here in WA?
Yeah, very strong comments coming through on that. Like I said, a lot of people in those regions are feeling like they're doing it tougher than any previous market downturn that they've been through, and doing it so tough that they're considering leaving the industry altogether. But pretty equal of extreme opinions across the board. So, you know, I think these things are always interesting points and times to reflect on, but it certainly feels like there is a tipping point in the industry that's being felt. And a lot of comments coming through about about people who are not prepared to join their ewes going forward. That was something that was raised, and very big concerns being raised about the future of the industry, particularly related to live exports. So that's obviously having, as we know, that's having a big impact on sentiment and confidence to sort of go forward in sheep production.
So as far as a priority issue for assistance over the next couple of weeks, what do you think that is?
I think predominantly it's still around getting the right feed into the people of the hands that need it the most. So I think, government should be commended on rolling out those support packages and that announcement of financial assistance. I think they should be commended for doing that very quickly. It's not often in these scenarios that we see a quick turnaround on these things. So that is good, and standing up the task force in the timeframe that they did. I think there has been a few calls for freight subsidies, and as I understand it, the money that's available at the moment can be put towards the freight costs. But I think we have to look at the trucking capacity realistically across the country when we're thinking about something like subsidies. So I think there are a few challenges there. To me, I really think it is around getting the feed supply up and getting it into the hands of people that need it. I think that's where, that'll be the critical need for the next couple of weeks.
And through the survey, did you get a sense of how people are coping?
Yeah, I think we had probably on balance the majority of responses were people are finding it pretty tough. I think everyone had sort of put through that, for themselves or people in their region, that they were doing it tougher than previous market downturns and doing it so tough that they're thinking about leaving the industry. So what does that mean? I mean, we certainly asked people if they wanted to be contacted further to be able to connect them with some forms of assistance. And we've done that for the people that provided their details, which was just about over 100 people. They've all been contacted by sheep producers, but we can't give their details, of course, to support networks. And there are really important resources available to support people with mental health, but it does require those producers to reach out to those services. So that's something that's going to be really important, that we need to just continue to make a space where people feel comfortable asking for help when they need it, and that they know who to call and where to get that advice and that information. I think incredibly important now more than ever is to really make sure that we're all looking out for each other and that we are being mindful of mental health issues, because there are certainly people who will be coming towards a tipping point that really need to be supported properly.
Bonnie, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bonnie Skinner is the CEO of Sheep Producers Australia. 12 past 12. One of the state's main mental health and community well-being programs says a lot of the mental stress in the community would be eased with a break to the season. Owen Catto is a senior community educator with the Regional Men's Health Initiative, which received $150,000 as part of the state government's $8.6 million drought assistance package. Owen, how are you reading the collective mental state of rural WA right now?
I guess we say, when we put the different situations in, not in order, but just in given their own strength, there's obviously a lot of distress, and it's peaking around the dryness to the start, and that's across the whole wheat belt, I guess. But people are just doing what they're doing in terms of farmers. The most recent one I spoke to on Saturday, big farming, 60% done, buggered, but just doing what they're doing, and they'll keep seeding till they finish. So, and hopefully then it has rained and that takes away a bit of that distress. And then I guess the other seasonal distresses are definitely around the export sheep and the even gun ownership and cost of production. And then when we go down to the sheep areas that are just trying to access water and feed for their sheep at the minute, because it's been a bloody long dry period. So that's another layer of distress, but just reaching a peak. And I say reaching a peak until it rains.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, there's farmers are just pressing ahead and keeping busy doing what they do. And a lot of them at the moment, as you mentioned, seeding and pressing on with the seeding, regardless of the fact there hasn't been any rain about. So it would be a very dusty old time in that seeder. But it is also quite a lonely time, and a lot of time just sitting in there. Does that sort of weigh on people's minds when they're just sitting for many, many hours doing a job like that, and just things just ruminating in the mind?
Look, it does. And that uncertainty, and you had a dash of uncertainty in your own business or personal life, and it just increases that anxiety and makes us ruminate over a whole lot of issues that may be in and outside of our business. And I guess what we say to people is give ourselves permission to feel like shit, for want of a better word, and to feel uncomfortable, because we do all react differently, and we've got incredible capacity. You know, it never ceases to amaze me, Belinda, the individual capacity of farmers and what they do, and they're bloody good at doing it, but their capacity to deal with the various issues, including the weather, is second to none. And we're all different. Everyone is different, so they're going to be thinking about different stuff in that time in the tractor going backwards and forwards.
And is your phone ringing hot?
Look, it's not, Belinda, not much different than normal, but I'm in saying that I speak to myself and my team, but I'll speak to, you know, between 5 and 10 farmers or agribusiness people a week just about how seeding's going and where they're at. But our phone is not any different than any other time in the years gone by for this time of the year.
Right. And does that surprise you at all?
Look, it does a little bit, but people need time to digest, and because we're all different, to access whatever help they need to. And look, farmers are really flat out dealing with the here and now. And, you know, because it's understand a very stressful period, you know, they put themselves last and the personal stuff. So they're worried about their livestock and feeding and water and the guy seeding, and just worried about getting finished seeding, being buggered because they're all worn out already, and thinking about when it is going to rain.
And very often, I mean, you're present at some of the big events that go on around the state. You know, have a presence there, and it might just trigger someone to go, oh, well, I might just have that call or go and speak to someone.
And we find that a lot, Belinda. That's what happens. It's this innate build-up in people, and they'll come along to a field day or see us at an event and go, geez, I was going to talk to you guys, or I was going to ring you guys. I've got that fridge magnet, talk to a mate on the fridge, give you a ring. So some people, in our individual capacity varies, as I've already mentioned. It just takes time to pick up a phone and if they need a hand. But we do have to remember as well that the majority of people in these scenarios, when our back's up against the wall, can sort the stuff out in their own way.
Oh, and great to talk to you. Thank you so much. And you've got a couple of events even coming up this week. What have you got lined up?
Yeah, look, we're out and about in those hot spots as well down south, Belinda. So last week we were down at in Dairy Country, Brunswick Junction, and then over at Woodlands or Albany for some recovery chats, informal info sessions that they're having, Western Beef. And this week, we're at Waroona and Kirrup on Tuesday and Thursday, and then the following week over at Boy Up Brook for a men's mental health night. So just out and about, and if people want to have a chat, come up and have a chat, and we'll make ourselves available. And we get our backside to where we're asked to go, Belinda, so that's the feature of our model. So let's hope it rains sooner than later.
Really good to talk to you, Owen. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Owen Catto, he's from the Regional Men's Health Initiative, which is based at Northam. And Owen and his team, they're easy to find. Just search Regional Men's Health Initiative and you'll find the number. It is 6314-1436. But if you didn't have a pen on you, just do that search on the web for Regional Men's Health Initiative and you'll find it. As Owen was saying, you know, some people in tough times, they can get through and that's fine. But others, you know, that phone call makes a huge difference. So figure out where you sit. And if you need the help, it is there. And you just need to ring one of those organisations. The Blue Tree was another one that got some funding out of the $8.6 million drought assistance package from the state government. And, of course, Owen's Regional Men's Health Initiative too. Rural West was there too, if my memory serves me correctly. But plenty of help there if you need it. 19 past 12. Well, chair of the grower group, A Sheep and Beef, says it's time for producers to move forward and start transforming the WA sheep industry. Group Chair Dave Vandenberg has written to the Prime Minister to express the industry's disgust in the government's treatment of the industry, the timing of the decision to end the live sheep trade and the poultry $107 million transition package. He says while it was important to express how the industry feels, it's clear the government will not change its mind. Here's what Anthony Albanese had to say about the phase-out of the sheep trade on ABC Perth this morning.
Well, we, of course, have committed to that at the last two elections. And what we've done is put a timeline on of 2028, so a long time for the industry to transition. We've provided more support with in excess of $100 million of transitional support to assist the industry. That's greater than the level of exports in the last year. The sheep meat industry is worth $4.5 billion. It is an industry that has been growing at the same time as the live sheep industry has been decreasing. We think this is a sensible proposition. We had extensive consultation with people involved in the industry, and we want to work with them and work with the WA government to make sure that the industry and to provide support for that transition.
The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese on ABC Perth this morning. Dave Vandenberg says it's clear the government has tuned out to the sheep industry.
They haven't listened at all, and I don't think they will listen, and it seems like they don't care. I don't know what they expect us to do, but their package was certainly insignificant on the cost it's going to put on industry. So we really had to just express our displeasure.
So you've written a letter. What are you hoping you may actually get out of it? Or is it just the fact of voicing that displeasure?
Well, I don't think they'll change their mind. They really don't care. I mean, I don't think anyone was that surprised that they brought out this ruling, but I think it's the timing and the nastiness of it and the total disregard for the current situations we're in. To do it now was like salt in the wound, for sure.
You mentioned the $107 million transition package. $107 million is a lot of money. Would it not be helpful in some way?
Well, if you break it down, and there's very short on detail, but I think about at least $40 million is going to get softened back into current operations of government, and we'll never see that. The $67 million, if you divide that by 5 years, it's, you know, a bit over $12 million a year. I think half of that will be in administration. So I'd be surprised if we see much at all, to be honest.
What do you do, Dave?
Well, I think now we have to move on. Let the lobby groups and the politicians argue it out and you know, fight it out in the media. But we have to save our industry. So it's a good opportunity to have a good look at our industry, get to get the processes, work out how we're going to tackle this. I mean, agriculture has been faced with, you know, things like this before. We've had, you know, China pulling out of the barley market recently. We've had years ago Iraq, we were not allowed to sell wheat to Iraq, and that was our major market. So we can rebound. It's just a matter of getting together and working out how we do this.
You talk about getting together and lobby groups in particular. We've seen in the last few days the NFF have voted a motion of no confidence in the federal government. So who needs to do this? Who do you go to put this together?
Look, I think leave the lobby groups to fight with Canberra, but we need to get together as producers and processors and our state government. The state government seems to want to work with us, and they're keen to do things. We need to address the immediate problems, and that's getting some sheep that we don't need out of this state. The freight rebate, or whatever you want to call it, that looks like a good option, but it's really up to the dry season task force to put that forward to government, and I think they're meeting soon. So hopefully they put through some good recommendations. But we need to start working towards this transition as quick as we can.
Now, the Shadow Ag Minister has said that his government, an alternative government, would reinstate the trade. Dave, do you feel like the damage may have already been done by that point, or could that potentially happen?
Look, it could potentially happen, but you can't sit back and wait for that to may happen. I mean, they may not get elected yet. The damage may well be done. And in fact, you've already seen the boats not turning up this month. So I think realistically, we've got to work on it not happening. And if it does, well, that's a bonus. You know, look, it's going to add more, you know, competition to the market.
So what is the plan? Because we've heard this week from the Shearing Industry Association talking about if there are sheep leaving the system, then that's going to mean less shearers and that's going to impact on rural towns. So this isn't just a farming issue. This is a rural, specifically WA issue.
Absolutely. And I mean, probably the first thing we really need to do, apart from the immediate welfare issues to sort out our industry, you know, with our oversupply of sheep, you know, we need to be part of the group that appoints this transition officer or whatever they're called. Because if we leave it to government, we're just as likely to get it from an animal rights party, and you know they'll be put in charge of transitioning our industry, and that'll be a disaster. So we need to forget the government, the federal government, and work closely with processors and our government. And look, there's abattoirs not in use currently. So there's probably three abattoirs that aren't working. We need to, you know, perhaps we could look at getting them up and going one way or another. It's a good opportunity to change farms and drought-proof them with feedlots and consignment feeding, you know, maybe some low-interest loans to transition a few of them farms so they can, you know, get animals ready for processing.
I know it has been a blow, this announcement that the transition will happen if the current government is re-elected. But given it was looming, I suppose, for the better part of a year, do you feel that now the decision has been made, it's been made public, that it is time to move on, or you can move on?
Look, we have to. We have to. If we, every day we don't make changes and improve our industry is a day later, and it's causing, you know, it's going to have a snowing effect. We need to speed things up as much as we can. You know, look, there is going to be a percentage of people that'll say, that's it, I'm out of sheep, I'm going. But really, everyone's got their own reasons, but if you're doing it because of the live export, well, that gives the animal justice parties and those crowd, that gives them a win, really, and I think we're better than that. We're tougher than that. There's still opportunity. The world still wants our product. We just need to change how we do it and do it in a hurry.
A sheep and beef chair and Skadden farmer David Vandenberg speaking to Tara de Landgraft. A few of you wanting to have your say on text today. Sebastian says, been farming 40-plus years, family farming five generations. It is a shocking season and the live export ban also horrible timing. But the big difference is when many farmers felt a bit abandoned by governments in previous dumps, this one many feel under attack from government and activists. Muzz is saying, where is Murray Watt? Haven't seen or heard of him getting around the state to see how bad things are and showing us how to handle things. He seems to think he knows what's best for us. And Michelle in Coolin, I cannot even stand to listen to Elbo. He has no concept. 4 years is nothing and $107 million is laughable. And now the ute tax too. Hopefully they'll be gone at the next election. They hate agriculture, says Michelle, 0448 922 604. Well, the phase out of the live exports isn't the only reason Simon Thomas is having doubts about staying in the sheep industry. Simon runs about 1,000 sheep and 6,000 goats at Marin Station near Carnarvon, and it is one of the state's most northern sheep producers. Wild dogs are always a worry, but he says his wild dog problem seems to be getting worse.
Yeah, it would be fair to say that we've lost in the vicinity of about, you know, 300 sheep and goats.
And when you're going out into the paddock and you're seeing these animals that are either mauled or dead, what's kind of going through your mind? How are you feeling each time you see this?
Oh, it's obviously very upsetting and also very frustrating. And you're doing your best with your animal husbandry as far as, you know, looking after their welfare, and then also having to have the added pressures of dog attack, which in a lot of ways you don't have any particular control over because you can't be with the animals 24/7. But, you know, what we're finding is that often dogs will just play with the stock, you know, so they won't necessarily kill them, but just the bites, particularly around the neck and the back end, normally leads to eventual death through infection, etc. So, you know, that they could injure 20 or 30 at a time.
What means of protection do you have in place? Why are these dog attacks so devastating for you at the moment?
What we did when we first came to Marin, the fencing was pretty dysfunctional. So the first thing that we've done, and with the help of our neighbours, we've put up a netting fence all around Marin. So we've got 120 kilometres of fairly, you know, significant dog fence. It's not like your normal barrier fence, which is generally hot, a bit higher and has an apron as well. But our fencing is still pretty significant, and it does do a lot to actually, you know, stop dogs coming in onto Marin. So that's been one of our main barriers. Stock grids on roads are a weak point. They tend to come over grids. And then obviously we're quite reliant on dog control inside as well. And we do have a pest manager. Their funding with that is so stretched that, you know, to be honest, it's getting to the point where there needs to be significant funding put in to make this process more effective. We're up against it a bit with more and more land is being taken over by government departments of varying types, and obligations under those are actually changing. So the efforts on them managing and controlling their own pests tending to be ignored. A lot of it isn't happening at all. So those animals are obviously, you know, coming out of those places and then impacting other neighbouring stations.
With all of that then, and obviously, you know, having such high numbers of kill rates from these wild animals, or these wild dogs, sorry, why do you still farm sheep and goat?
I've been asking myself the same question lately, to be honest. With, you know, stock prices are absolutely woeful, and yeah, we are obviously at the whim with dog attack. I know there's others in the area who are considering getting out of small animals and going to cattle, because dogs, whilst they do affect cattle, don't have the same impact. We'll be running cattle on our eastern side instead of small animals, just to act as a bit of a buffer. So by having, yeah, cattle country, so to speak, we can actually hopefully get to those dogs before they come through onto our western side, which be primarily will still be the small animals.
Given that you were saying as well the sheep market isn't very strong, what are you doing to make up the lost costs?
We've always tended to do off-farm activities. We also do quite a lot of earth moving, work with shires, with road reconstruction, etc. So that has bankrolled a lot of the stuff that we've done here on Marin. If we hadn't have had an outside income, there's no way we could have done what we've done here so far.
Simon Thomas, he's from Marin Station. He was speaking to Sophia Alston about his problem with wild dogs. It is 27 to 1. Jonathan Hopper here from the newsroom with the headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. WA police have launched a manhunt for a convicted armed robber, once described as Australia's most wanted man after he removed his electronic monitoring bracelet. 57-year-old Brett Ronald Maston was last seen in Mount Lawley area this morning. Anyone who sees Maston is urged not to approach him, but to contact police immediately. The Iranian Red Crescent Society says no signs of life have been detected at the wreckage of a crashed helicopter that was carrying the country's president. Ebrahim Raisi and other officials were flying over a remote mountainous region in Iran's north when the helicopter came down. It took search teams more than 12 hours to be able to locate and reach the crash site by foot, hampered by thick fog and icy weather. And American golfer Xander Schauffele has won the PGA Championship in Kentucky with a 6-foot birdie putt on the final hole. Schauffele finished on 21 under to claim his first major by a shot from Bryson DeChambeau. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. Appreciate that. It is 26 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Just before the news at 1, it's off to Mushay for the results of the cattle market today. Terry Birkin will go through those details. And the half-year profits for agribusiness giant Elders have fallen 72% compared with the same time last year. So to get to the bottom of what's going on there, shortly you'll hear from the chief executive, Mark Allison. First, though, off to the Bureau of Meteorology and Luke Huntington with you today. Luke, should we start with a look at the Southwest Land Division? What's happening today and for the rest of the week? What have you got?
Yeah, afternoon, Belinda. So we've seen this stubborn high continuing in the bite there. So it's producing non-precipitating weather at the moment, so it's pretty dry out there. And it looks like that's going to be the case for most of the week, but there is just a very weak cold front just clipping the far southwestern corner tomorrow. So along the coast between sort of Margaret River to Albany, we might see 1 to 2 millimetres, and then just through the adjacent inland there, maybe just a less than a millimetre. So it's a very weak cold front, not producing much. I guess later in the week, the story is that we do have sort of a moderate cold front approaching the west coast later in the day on Friday. This doesn't look like a very spectacular front itself. It doesn't, in terms of rainfall producing, and it doesn't look like it extends that far inland as well. So just to give you an idea, just some rainfall figures on that one, around 1 to 10 millimetres expected. It looks very, very coastal, though, that sort of 10 millimetres, and that would be near the coast between Bunbury and Augusta, and then sort of less than 5 millimetres anywhere from sort of southwest of Kalbarri to Esperance, southwest of Kalbarri to Albany, sorry. But anywhere east of that, you're not expecting any rainfall. So this is not a one that's going to push right through to the agricultural areas. And then if I look longer term than that, the models are going for a follow-up front possibly later Sunday, which may produce a little bit more rainfall. But again, it doesn't look like a real significant front. So it does look like the pattern is changing from Friday. We're starting to see a couple of cold fronts move through. So hopefully that high is breaking down once and for all.
Well, I'm trying to think whether that's a sign or not, Luke. Is that how you're reading it, with like a series of these fronts, nothing amazing coming out of them, but because of the number of them, are we seeing some kind of change in the pattern, do you think?
Yeah, it's certainly looking that way. It's certainly it's certainly a different pattern to what we've seen in the last couple of months, when these constant highs moving through and all the cold fronts are being blocked to the south. So the climate outlooks are going for sort of a near average winter, sort of through June, July, August, and they are specifically saying that that we should be getting more cold fronts once we get into June. So hopefully this is the start of a number of cold fronts moving through.
Yeah, great. Okay. Northern and eastern parts, how's it looking?
Yeah, over the north, staying relatively dry, and it's particularly windy at the moment. When you do get that strong high in the bite, you see those windy conditions up north with those fresh and gusty easterly winds. It's leading to some extreme fire dangers just along parts of the Pilbara coast there near Karratha and Port Hedland. So there is a warning out there for today, and we'll most likely have one in that area for tomorrow. The winds ease off on Wednesday, so we'll probably go back to high fire dangers. But no precipitation is on the horizon. Maybe with that cold front, it may clip the very far southwestern Gascoyne near Denham there. But otherwise, it's going to be a dry week.
All right, Luke, thank you for going through those details. Appreciate that. 22 to 1. And from 9 a.m. Friday to 9 o'clock this morning, no rain recorded anywhere at all in Western Australia, and it is two-thirds of the way through May, as you know. I did call James Ashley. He is the manager of the Bureau here in Western Australia, and I thought it might be good to have him on the Country Hour tomorrow, because it was about a month ago he was here, and he was saying we'd start seeing some sort of change in the patterns around about this time towards mid to end May. And I think he might have a little bit of an update on that situation for you. So we'll have a chat to him around about this time on the Country Hour tomorrow. 22 to 1 and off to Mushay just before the news at 1 for the results of the cattle market. And this year, the Vigus family is celebrating its centenary of farming in the far south of Western Australia. Mark Bennett went along to a gathering of 80 descendants at Tingledale, west of Denmark, near the Valley of the Giants. And it was a day to remember how hard it must have been back in 1924 when their ancestors arrived from England to take up forest blocks and try and convert them into small farms.
It's great to have you all here, and what we'll do is unveil the plaque out here. I'm Brian Vigus, the owner of the farm here, which grandfather named as Wyoming Farm, and when they first took it up, and we've carried that name on of the farm, and I'm the third generation of that, and we have our son, who's going to be the fourth generation, taking over part of the farm from us and his wife.
It's a proud story of resilience and determination to see through what would have been a very, very difficult beginning to the farm.
Oh, yes, yeah. There was. They came out from Cornwall in 1924, and there's 36 families, and there's only three from the original 36 left in the district. And now we've seen a lot of people come and a lot of people go, and they just couldn't handle the things. But these three families have stuck with it, and we haven't been millionaires or anything like that, but three feeds a day and half a bed, and you're right.
It would have started with what size of a holding to start with?
They were given roughly 300 acres, I think it was, with the what they had, yes. But each farm, before it got allotted, they had to ring bark 30 acres on each location, and then like, it was like a raffle, and they drew what location they got.
How on earth did they manage to clear the country?
A lot of it was just horses, cross-cut saws and fire. And it wasn't until after the Second World War did the bulldozers arrive in the district. And that's when things started to go better. And, of course, we're still milking cows. They didn't have many. And, yeah, it's just butter fat and hard work and perseverance.
Judy Ross, I was a Vigus, daughter of Tom Vigus. I've put all the family tree together. When they arrived on the 12th of May here in Tingledale with the group settlement, group 116, it was raining. They had an inch of rain that day, and they had 9 inches for the month of May, so everything became a quagmire. If you've ever been to the treetop walk and see the bush, the trees, that is what they landed in, and they had to clear it by hand. Our grandfather, he was in the Merchant Navy, so he didn't know about the land. As a lot of others weren't farmers when they came here, they were told that the farm would be here for them, with a house, and they showed brochures and stuff. But no, they had to build it first.
All these settlers came from England at what would have just been on the post-First World War.
Sir James Mitchell and the West Australian government set up this group settlement scheme for servicemen because of the unemployment queues and stuff were so long in Britain. So they set up this scheme for them to come to the southwest, Denmark, Tingledale, Pemberton, Northcliffe, all those areas they came to. It's very hard life. They were actually lied to what they were to come to. After a while, very short time, there's only a lot of them left because they just couldn't handle the loneliness and the hardship. And only five remained.
Pauline Owning, daughter of Tom and Wilma Vigus. I've lived here, worked on the farm, helped Dad after I left school till I was about 15. I used to help Dad cut fence posts and do the fencing.
We all helped on the farm.
Yeah, milked the cows.
Milked the cows, fed the calves, fed the pigs. We all mucked in and did our chores, and we slashed the bracken. That's another story.
It was as high as us, the bracken.
Judy Ross talking to Mark Bennett about her family farming in that Denmark region for 100 years. It is 17 to 1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Half-year profits for agribusiness giant Elders have fallen 72% compared with the same time last year. In an announcement to the Australian Stock Exchange today, Elders reported its underlying profit after tax was just $14.4 million. That's Elders' worst result in a decade. Chief Executive Mark Allison says nationally it was an unusual and incredibly challenging start to the reporting year, but the outlook is better for the months and years ahead.
You know, I haven't seen, I've been running ag companies for 40 years. I ran in the industry for 40 years and running ag companies for 30 years. And I haven't seen it where, so the weather forecasts were for El Nino. On the back of that, And in combination with interest rate environment, geopolitical environment, some of the other policies that were being put forward on a geopolitical front or domestic front, I think there was quite a cautious sentiment with the thought that it would be drier than average. A lot of particularly northern producers felt that they needed to destock because they'd have to be paying for feed. There was a hold put on planting inputs, so for pre-fertiliser, fallow spraying with weed control, because the thought was that it would be drier than average. And then that slowed everything to hand to mouth. So I think it's a combination of factors, and that sentiment's still out there to an extent. But of course, what happened in the as we came through after Christmas and in the new year, there was extensive rainfall through a number of the agricultural areas in eastern Australia.
And seeing the flow on of that into things like your resale and wholesale sales, things people purchasing things less, like crop protection, fertiliser down, animal health and seed products were up. So a bit of a mixed bag from the retail front.
Yeah, I think so. Once the value of livestock started to improve, then people are willing to spend more money on veterinary products for them, etc. But it's not dissimilar to what we've seen in metropolitan retail, just that sentiment of not buying discretionary stuff, only buying as late as you need to buy. But, of course, in agriculture, it's not a consumer situation. It's an industrial production situation where, it meant that the systems changed. I mean, getting rid of cattle, then when it was clear that it wasn't actually going to be an El Nino, then needing to buy cattle back in because you had more grass than you could poke a stick at was, it just makes for another degree of difficulty and uncertainty.
As you say, things started to turn around in the second quarter. Now we've got current dry conditions across many parts of the country again, so WA, South Australia, Victoria in particular. How much will a good break and the timing of that for winter crops and for winter plantings influence things going forward?
I think for a big chunk of eastern Australia, the prime planting time is Anzac Day, and there was good rainfall through the through those cereal areas like 10 days before Anzac Day. So it was like it was an early break as opposed to a normal break. And that kind of covers a number of areas. Obviously, it's still dry in South Oz, particularly the peninsulas and Victoria as well. In Western Australia, speaking with big growers over there, that they tend to dry seed, and knowing the rain will come later. And so there's over 50% of the crop, I think, has been dry seeded in the west. And what that means from an elder's viewpoint is that there may be lower inputs pre-plant, but then clearly NPK and fertilisers required to grow a crop and pest control, there tends to be more weed activity in crop if there hasn't been pre-plant applications made. So from our viewpoint, we see it as kind of average in some areas, above average, but an average season. And across the whole of Australia, the size of the winter crop only fluctuates, regardless of drought or flood or whatever, fluctuates in the area of 10% across the whole of Australia.
What about expectations for livestock prices? So you mentioned, obviously, political factors have an influence on these things as well. We had a recent announcement of the end of live export of sheep by sea, an expectation of perhaps seeing some ripple effects of that on markets and prices across the country this far out as producers reassess their positions?
Yeah, I think we've largely seen that. And this goes to my earlier point of the sentiment early on, because the gap or the difference between sheep prices in WA and South Australia and Eastern Australia was significant, to the point where processors were travelling to Western Australia and could buy sheep there, transport them back to Eastern Australia, and still come and get ahead of the cost game. So I think that uncertainty has largely played out in the sheep trade. I was in beef a couple of weeks ago, and there's also the concern that there may be a knock-on effect on the northern Australian live export market, which would be quite problematic, a massive positive industry, and like the sheep trade in the west, with animal welfare standards, which are world-class. There's no doubt they're world-class. So I think that plays to the sentiment comment I made earlier. But in terms of the macroeconomic drivers, we'd expect it seems that the predictions are for solid livestock prices going forward, and on the cattle front, with the herd running down in North America, particularly US, there is some supply pressure that may help it to stay higher.
Elders Managing Director and Chief Executive Mark Ellison speaking to Selena Green, and he's confident Elders will still meet profit targets, but reporting today to the ASX an underlying profit after tax of just $14.4 million. That's down 72% compared with the same time last year. This on the text from Mark in Albany. Farmers have been leaving Elders in droves. For 2 years, local branches were frustrated by head office not acting on pricing. In the end, Elders was just price matching. Farmers' concerns weren't being listened to, and so we left. Now they're trying to undercut competitors to get market share back. They only have themselves to blame, says Mark. Thank you for that, Mark. 10 to 1 here on the Country Hour. A fish farm in southern New South Wales is trying to develop a new export market to China for Australia's aquaculture industry. Uwara Fisheries is exporting thousands of golden perch fingerlings to China, which will then be grown up and sold in the local market. Managing Director John Yu thinks there's plenty of appetite in China for Australia's native fish.
Australian native fish are very good table fish for human consumption. That's the first critical thing. And China is a really huge market for all fish and aquaculture. And so to be able to develop this sort of fish industry in China would have a really huge potential. So we reckon this is a beginning, but we will see that this is the area we want to expand into.
How does it work? Are you selling fish to be bred over there? Are you selling to another company? Or do you have a breeding program over there? How does this all work?
Well, actually, we send them fingerlings for them to grow out there, so it's not a breeding program. It is just for them to grow out there so that they can have the type of fish for consumption, human consumption. Eventually, they would definitely do their own breeding there. But the thing is, native fish always do the best in their native habitat. And so once they're in China, over years, they would deteriorate in quality. And so eventually, here in Australia, always produce the best quality fish.
So can you tell me a bit, what is actually the demand like in China for golden perch and other Australian natives?
Actually, nobody is growing golden perch at the moment, but Murray Cod, there are some growers. Definitely, there's a huge demand for it because basically the fish fresh is top quality fish, premium fish, but they don't have enough to supply the local demand nearly. And China is the biggest country in the world for aquaculture. So people there traditionally, they can fish is one of the best protein compared with like cattle or chicken. So always love fish.
How much golden perch have you sent over to China to be grown and eventually sold on in the local market?
Before the pandemic, we sent about 30,000. But since the pandemic, we haven't been able to do so because the airlines and all those are unreliable. And we only started the program again this year.
So do you know how many you might be sending this year?
This year, we only can manage to do one batch, so we are looking around 50,000.
And you said that you're looking to expand that. So what are you looking to do in that area?
Well, send more, basically, at the start. And there are people there really eagerly waiting for the fingerings. So there are growers already really keen to participate and get involved.
Do you have any goals of how much you would actually like to be able to send to China in the next, you know, say 4 or 5 years?
Well, we get order from people for next year. They are talking about 10 million, but I don't think we can produce that many.
Sorry, someone's asked you for 10 million
Correct.
Golden perch.
Yes, so you can imagine what this could be in a few years' time. We only started talking about it last year. And now somebody wanted to have a 10 million fingerings, which I simply can't produce that many.
You are a fisheries managing director, John Yu, speaking to Lucas Forbes. And maybe there's an opportunity there to grow those fingerlings out here. And then export them? I don't know, maybe. On the text, Peter says, fish? Live export, huh? Imagine my utter shock at hypocrisy here. Thank you, Peter. 6 minutes to 1 o'clock. Now, over in the US state of Louisiana, there are almost 1 million alligators being raised on farms, but none of the alligators are fed meat. Nathan Wall has farmed in Louisiana for nearly four decades and says their whole industry has moved to feeding alligators a soy-based pellet.
Yeah, so we actually feed as much as 13 times a week, twice a day, and then a lot of farms feed once on Sunday. So the animals are, I'm going to call it this way, they fed likely better than most people in America because they get fed so many times. But it's an extruded pellet, and what the companies have done, some of the feed companies of what they've been able to create, is what is the necessary nutrients for the crocodilians, which is alligators for the United States. So what they did is they took from what is the necessary needs from a crocodilian and then been able to create a pellet that is an extruded pellet. It's very high in protein. The average protein is around 50%. And then on a fat level, around 14%, then it has all the vitamin, mineral supplements that an animal would need to be able to thrive. And then that pellet also floats. So even if it gets off its pad, then it can get in the water and an alligator can still eat the extruded pellet because it also floats.
Do any farms feed their alligators meat?
None whatsoever. We literally are very familiar with all the farms. It's a small industry in the United States. The entire United States probably produces maybe a total of 350,000 production a year, and no one feeds meat back to the alligators. Now, when they're out in the wild and domestically, then obviously they're going to eat fish and some of the other varmints, and they're more meat in that aspect. But because of our extruded pellet, actually we took meat, broke it down, no different than they have the veggie patty. We created a veggie pellet for the alligators, and that way there's no meat fed back to them. So it's pretty cool.
Do you think they mind, the alligators?
They thrive. We do a lot of testing, so we do a tremendous amount of research. We have veterinarians as full-time. We also have a biologist and scientist as full-time at the farm. So we do all the testing upon the stress levels and upon growth. We track every aspect of everything. So they do not mind. Everyone I've asked said they have an excellent, satisfactory diet.
Nathan Wall, he's an alligator farmer from Louisiana. He was speaking to Dan Fitzgerald. 3 minutes to one to the markets now, and about 400 head of cattle sold at this morning's sale at Mouche, so numbers down about 50 on last week. Terry Birkin's been at the sale today. Hello, Terry. Can you run through those market details?
Hi, Belinda. Numbers continue to be low and are expected to continue to be at least until the end of June. All categories were fairly evenly presented, both in sex and condition, from very well-finished grain-assisted steers and heifers down to tail-end, light-frame, local and pastoral cattle. The grain-assisted cattle made up most of the lots in double digits, and the rest of the sale was mostly made up of odds and sods of 1 to 4 animals per pen. Most of the regular buying group presented themselves, maintaining recent gains, along with several fresh faces in the restocker market. Light and plain veal steers made from 100 to 180 cents, while steers showing more cover sold to 260 cents a kilo. Plain veal heifers ranged from 40 to 170 cents, and with more frame and weight to 188 cents a kilo. Yearling steers were consistent, returning 180 to 290 cents, while plain yearling heifers were selling from 80 cents to 168 cents, and with finished weight sold to a top of 274 cents a kilo. The few grown steers available made 220 to 232 cents, while grown heifers averaged 236 cents a kilo. Further weight cows returned 50 to 150 cents, medium cows 150 to 198 cents, and prime cows sold to a top of 214 cents a kilo. Young bulls were mostly presented in plain condition and poorly bred, selling from 10 cents to 178 cents with better potential, While shipping bulls realised 130 to 215 cents, the slaughter bulls holding firm in recent lifts, selling to a top of 218 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you for going through those details. As I mentioned right at the start of the show today, there was one small donkey on offer today, and it sold for $300. I believe it was a local landholder that bought it. And the donkeys usually come in from the stations, and over the years they've varied in price from sort of $40 right up to around about $700. But when there's one or a few up for sale, they are always the main talking point at the yards. Back at Mouchet tomorrow for the results of the sheep market. I'll talk to you tomorrow, news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.